being with us. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
The KBOO Community Radio Artists in Residence Program application period is open. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artists in Residence program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. Applications for the KBOO 2017 Artists in Residence are due Friday, April 7th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/kboo AIR 2017.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Thirsty City, a monthly beat and rap night at the No in Portland. On Saturday, April 1st, Thirsty City hosts Los Angeles-based Future Funk aficionados Devin Hu and Zachy Force, along with Thodo Lane and Wood Ox. The homie Northern Draw will also be DJing. Again, that's Thirsty City at the No, 3728 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This is a 21 and up thing, so don't bring your kids. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and a grant from McMenamins presenting Yonder Mountain String Band, performing at the Crystal Ballroom on Friday, March 24th with the Little Smokies. All ages are welcome. 7:30 p.m. doors, 8:30 p.m. show. More information for Yonder Mountain String Band on Friday the 24th can be found at crystalballroom@pdx.com. And now your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Representative Paul Ryan admits defeat and withdraws the American Health Care Act prior to a vote.
The labor dispute at local TV station KGW has been settled.
And an overflow crowd attended today's funeral for Qantas Hayes.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 24th, 2017. I'm Ray Bodwell.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Earlier today at Philadelphia Community Missionary Baptist Church, Pastor Roy E. Clay presided over overflowing pews during an open community funeral service for 17-year-old Portlander Qantas Hayes. Qantas Hayes, known by his family and friends as Moose, was murdered by Portland Police Bureau's Andrew Hearst on February 9th of this year. Earlier this week, a grand jury found that Officer Hearst's use of force was justified. This is in spite of widespread doubts expressed about the veracity of the police report details. Qantas Hayes' family and racial justice activists with local organization Don't Shoot Portland have expressed that, aside from being an African-American male in unfavorable economic circumstances, Hayes posed no imminent threat to the officer's life. The following clips are taken directly from Hayes' funeral, which took place at 2 p.m. earlier this afternoon.
But what happens when a boy dies, cousin?
Yeah. Come on.
At some point, y'all gotta stop playing with these people like they playing with y'all. Young men, young women, they ain't playing with y'all lives. Don't look at this casket and just think we lost Moose. We lost Moose. This is the reality of the war that's on y'all lives, and y'all still playing with these people. Y'all still acting like the Portland police and other police bureaus around this nation look at young black men differently. That's a lie. some point, enough brands have to be set for y'all to get serious about the reality. Aquinas, Clayton, son, I love you, man. I swear I wish I'd have just gotten your help when I got home. Not because you was doing wrong, but because I understood that the minute you left by yourself, they would take your life from you. I swear as God is my witness, Clayton, your life will never be forgotten. And your legacy, this city legacy is now you, cousin. They will eat of the destruction of your life. And we will do all we can to seek justice.
According to a story in today's Oregonian, Portland Commissioner Nick Fish has directed his staff to no longer attend city council meetings. In a text to that publication, Fish is reported to have said, quote, "I have an obligation to maintain a safe workplace. Council meetings are no longer safe," end quote. Fish apparently gave the order after Wednesday's city council meeting, which many considered to be one of the most unruly in recent memory. Protesters yelled frequently throughout the afternoon session, wore gas masks, waved sticks, and yelled crude comments about Mayor Ted Wheeler's mother and others. In a posting to his Facebook page, Mayor Wheeler apologized to people who were attempting to testify, only to be shouted down by protesters. He referred to the protesters as hostile and abusive and wrote, quote, "I am saddened by the behavior of many attendees who are not there to participate in civil discourse, but to disrupt," end quote. The mayor has initiated biweekly forums where citizens are welcome to come and complain about city actions, but that has failed to appease the protesters. After the meeting, the mayor said that he will impose new rules which will allow him to remove disruptive protesters from city council meetings. The mayor said the protesters were in his yard on Thursday, shouting and making obscene hand gestures to his family and to himself. He woke this morning to find a flat tire in his car, but did not speculate on whether it had been slashed by one of the protesters.
A new study in the Journal of Environmental Research Letters has found that habitat destruction picked up dramatically around corn ethanol refineries since the passage of the Renewable Fuel Standard. Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service has more.
Wildlife habitat near corn ethanol refineries has been destroyed at a fast pace since a federal law was passed to produce more biofuels. A new study says within a 100-mile radius of ethanol plants, 4 million acres across the U.S. have been converted to agricultural use in the 4 years after passing the Renewable Fuel Standard. Oregon isn't part of the nation's Corn Belt, but study co-author Chris Wright at the University of Minnesota says these are the places where the most habitat destruction has occurred.
It was the ethanol refineries out on the periphery of the industry where we saw significant land use change.
Oregon has an ethanol refinery in Boardman. Congress passed the RFS in 2007 to require blending corn-based ethanol and other renewable fuels with gasoline. The study was conducted by researchers at the University of Minnesota Duluth, University of Wisconsin, and the National Wildlife Federation. Ben Larson with the National Wildlife Federation and a report co-author says the federal law contains language to protect wildlife habitat by not allowing recently converted land to be used for biofuel production. But he says the EPA took a shortcut in implementing the policy. Instead, it adds the total of all cropland and looks at whether it increases over time at the national level.
Well, at that national level, you really can't see the concentrated pockets of conversion that we show are happening around ethanol plants. It's like if you pull back from the earth far enough, you lose sight of where the impacts are happening.
Another study found 7 million acres of land nationwide have been converted to crop production in the 4 years following the RFS passage, with corn being the most common crop. Larson says this kind of conversion rate has a serious impact on wildlife.
For the wildlife species that rely on grasslands and wetlands that are being converted to cropland, habitat loss is not an academic issue. For instance, grassland birds as a group have suffered the most severe population declines of about any group of species. and that's largely as a result of habitat loss.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Workers at the local television station KGW in Portland have come to an agreement with management, ending a labor dispute that has gone on for several years. The station is the local NBC affiliate, and camera operators and editors there have been working for 2 years without a contract. Other workers at the station, including reporters, anchors, and control room operators, are represented by a different union. But they also had a labor dispute with the management, which was only recently resolved. The owner of KGW, Gannett Newspapers, acquired the station in 2013. The labor disputes have been going on since that time. But in 2015, Gannett created a new entity for its broadcast hall called Tegna. The management demanded that the unions change language in their contracts as to who was represented, a change which the workers said would undermine their union protections. This change was also pushed by the management at the 46 other television stations that they own. But at KGW, workers pushed back, and as of this week, they have been successful in maintaining their union representation and negotiating 2% raises for all employees. This new contract will run through 2020.
Early today, House Speaker Paul Ryan and his Republican majority admitted defeat and withdrew their attempt at Obamacare repeal. Realizing that they were doomed to failure, they pulled the American Health Care Act from further consideration. Speaking to reporters afterwards, Ryan said, quote, "I spoke to the president a little while ago. I told him the best thing I think to do was to pull this bill, and he agreed with that," end quote. He also said that repeal of the Affordable Care Act was unlikely at this time and that, quote, "we are going to be living with Obamacare for the foreseeable future," end quote. The move is seen as a huge setback for both the president and the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. Mr. Trump had repeatedly referred to Obamacare as a disaster and promised the American public that he would repeal and replace it with something better and cheaper that would cover everyone. House Republicans had been voting to repeal Obamacare for years, only to have it repeatedly vetoed by a previous administration. But in the end, Ryan and his team came up with a proposal that satisfied neither of the extremes of his party. The ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus felt that the AHCA didn't go far enough toward cutting the federal budget deficit, while moderate Republicans were concerned that the new bill would result in higher premiums, less coverage, and the loss of health insurance for 24 million Americans. The vote had originally been scheduled for Thursday, but was postponed to let the president have one more shot at convincing the Freedom Caucus to go along. When it became apparent that he had failed, the president advised Speaker Ryan that it was time to move on.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for a cloudy day with intermittent showers and temperatures in the mid-50s. East of the Cascades in Hood River, you can expect a mixture of clouds and sun with temperatures near 60. On this day in 1965, the Freedom Marchers arrived in Montgomery, Alabama. The marchers were organized by activists to demonstrate the desire of African-American citizens to exercise their constitutional right to vote. The quote of the day is from civil rights advocate Duchesne Stokes, who said, quote, "You are not under attack when others gain rights and privileges that you have always had."
This week, the House Intelligence Committee held public hearings that were supposed to be bipartisan and thorough. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has a few thoughts on how things are going so far.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts.
On Monday, the House Intelligence Committee held its public hearing into Russian involvement in the 2016 presidential election and Donald Trump's claim that he was wiretapped during that campaign by former President Barack Obama. Just prior to the start of what turned out to be a lengthy questioning of FBI Director James Comey and NSA Director Admiral Mike Rogers, Republican Chairman Devin Nunes appeared to set the stage for an open and nonpartisan session.
I hope that this committee's bipartisan investigation will result in a definitive report on the Russian actions taken during the election campaign. To that end, we encourage anyone who has information about these topics to come forward and speak to the House Intelligence Committee.
Then the questioning began, and almost immediately, FBI Director Comey invalidated Mr. Trump's wiretapping claim.
With respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration, I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI. The Department of Justice has asked me to share with you that the answer is the same for the Department of Justice and all its components. The department has no information that supports those tweets.
From that point, the hearing droned on for another 5 hours, ending with committee members from both sides of the aisle urging Director Comey and Admiral Rogers to do whatever was necessary to get to the truth. That facade of bipartisanship lasted until Wednesday. Chairman Nunes, longtime Republican Party hack and member of the Trump administration transition team, dashed to the White House to tell the president that he and some members of his campaign team were picked up as incidental surveillance during an ongoing FISA investigation. He then held a press conference to share that news with the world.
Today I briefed the president on the concerns that I had. This is information that was brought to me that I thought the president needed to know about incidental collection, where the president himself and others in the Trump transition team were clearly put into intelligence reports.
Only after that was done did he share the news with the other members of his committee, both Democratic and Republican. Not surprisingly, other committee members, especially Democrats, were not amused by Chairman Nunes' break in protocol. Ranking Minority Representative Adam Schiff of California had this to say.
Chairman will need to decide whether he is the chairman of an independent investigation into conduct, which includes allegations of potential coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians, or he is going to act as a surrogate of the White House, because he cannot do both. But on the basis of what the chairman has said and on the basis of my conversation with the chairman, I can say this. There is still no evidence that the president was wiretapped by his predecessor.
Sadly, there's nothing surprising about the fact that this investigation may deteriorate into yet another intramural catfight between the Democrats and Republicans in Congress, which probably explains why the approval rating for Congress is even lower than that of President Trump. In fact, the Gallup poll hasn't had congressional approval ratings over 25% since the start of the Obama administration. That was about the time that the Republicans set a goal of making Obama a one-term president. About the time that the Republicans set a goal of making Obama a one-term president. Something else they failed at. Arizona Senator John McCain summed up the situation regarding the poorly named House Intelligence Committee this way during a CNN interview on Wednesday.
This back and forth and what the American people have found out so far, that no longer does the Congress have credibility to handle this alone.
With that comment, McCain was narrowly referring to the investigation into Trump's wiretap claim and Russian interference. But as we think about the Congress that has approved Trump's clown car of a cabinet, while working to systematically strip away what little safety net the average American still has, perhaps the Arizona Republican should have eliminated a few words and broadened his message to simply say this.
The American people have found out that no longer does the Congress have credibility.
For KBOO, this is Ray Bogwell. Yesterday, Canada's largest school system announced that they have decided to discontinue school trips to the United States. The Toronto District School Board said that they would stop scheduling the trips to shield students from, quote, potentially being turned away at the border, end quote. The board, which serves about 250,000 students, said that 24 trips that had already been approved would be allowed to proceed, but that they would bring all the students home if any individual student was turned away. The move comes in response to the Trump administration's travel bans aimed at keeping people from several predominantly Muslim countries from entering the U.S. Canada is a very diverse society with a history of welcoming refugees, and school board chairman Robin Pilkey said, quote, "We're committed to equity, inclusiveness, and fairness, and it's not appropriate that some students would not be able to attend based on the country of their birth. The school board's decision follows an announcement on March 15th that the Girl Guides of Canada, a group comparable to the Girl Scouts of the USA, was also suspending travel to the U.S.
The State Department announced Friday that it has issued a presidential permit allowing construction of the Keystone XL pipeline to begin. The project was put on ice in Obama's second term and then revived by executive order in the first week of Trump's presidency. The pipeline is designed to carry oil from Canadian tar sands to the Gulf Coast refineries in Texas and has been the focus of years of campaigning by climate activists. The southern leg of the pipeline from Oklahoma to the Gulf Coast was constructed separately. Environmentalists say the project depends on the dirtiest form of fossil fuel when the focus should be on investing in renewables. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is pushing for a $2.5 billion downsizing at the Environmental Protection Agency, putting the EPA at the top of the White House funding cuts list in the 2018 budget proposal blueprint. SFSRN's Hannah Lee Myers reports from Denver, those proposed cuts, putting thousands of EPA projects and careers in limbo, are causing the public to push even harder on lawmakers to defend federal environmental protection.
Give them hell. In solidarity with a crowd out front, around 10 young people squeeze into a cramped entryway at Colorado Senator Michael Bennett's offices.
My name is Megan, and this is Elizabeth. We are with the Colorado People's Alliance, and we would like to talk with some of your staff today in regard to the Trump administration's proposed budget cuts to the EPA.
Okay. Like many social and environmental justice groups nationwide, they're demanding lawmakers push back on the 31% EPA funding cut outlined in the Trump administration's 2018 budget proposal blueprint.
So it's a deep cut. It'll be moving employees out the door. And there's even rumors that two of the 10 regional offices may have to disappear. Denver was included in one. We'll see some extreme retrenchment on the progress that the agency's made in the last four decades.
Wes Wilson worked for the EPA for 35 years as an environmental engineer, and now he's a member of Save EPA, a group of former employees rallying in support of the agency. Before taking the job as EPA director, Scott Pruitt, as Oklahoma Attorney General, was one of the agency's fiercest foes. He openly refutes the science that human activity is the main driver behind climate change, and he wants to leave enforcement up to the states.
I really want to work with locals, counties, cities, towns across this country, set some benchmarks. How are we going to improve? And I want to hear from you on how to do that.
And although collaboration sounds nice, Wilson says it could be a disaster in disguise.
EPA maintains a series of top professionals, PhDs and scientists within its laboratory system. You know, we have experts on everything from cryptosporidium to lead consequences in young children. We have this expertise that's not replicated in the states. And I think the president does not understand, nor does Pruitt understand, and perhaps not even care. But it takes a team, and it's not going to be done when you take one team member as critical as EPA out of the game.
Major funding cuts at the EPA could have a huge impact on state-level health care and environmental initiatives. Martha Rudolph, director of environmental programs at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, explains.
The federal funding is a big deal. We get about $30 million a year. This is for this last fiscal year from EPA. That represents about a third of our total budget for the environmental programs.
Those programs include the state drinking water, clean air, and hazardous waste programs, as well as funds set aside for the cleanup of Superfund sites. Nearly half of the country's 54 Superfund cleanup sites are in Colorado. Funding cuts could also affect the EPA's ability to clean up its own mess, like the site in Silverton, Colorado, where in 2015 an EPA subcontractor released millions of gallons of toxic waste out of the Gold King mine into the Animas River. Colorado lawmakers say new EPA leaders have assured them the Gold King mine cleanup will continue. And Pruitt has said the cleanup projects are agency priorities.
Superfund is an area that is absolutely essential and an objective that we have as part of our administration.
Many aren't surprised the EPA is using the high-profile spill to show cuts won't stop big cleanup projects. However, hundreds of miles of abandoned mines in the Rocky Mountains are leaking acidic fluid daily without making headlines. With a third of the EPA's budget on the chopping block, it's unlikely that larger but less media-friendly issue will be resolved anytime soon.
And they're coming together.
Back in Denver, members of Colorado People's Alliance emerge from their meeting with Senator Michael Bennett's staff. The group's speaker, Megan Guyader, recounts the discussion with cautious optimism.
It definitely felt more official than kind of standing outside and holding signs and chanting. And I mean, that has its time and place, but it was very cool that these are the staffers that are actually working on shaping this policy. So, yeah, that felt good.
Until the 2018 budget is finalized, nothing is certain, other than the fact that rallies like the one at Senator Bennett's office in Denver will continue across the country as concerned citizens put increasing pressure on local lawmakers to fight on their behalf. Hanley Myers, FSRN, Denver.
Citizens of the United Kingdom have harshly criticized Donald Trump Jr. after an ill-considered tweet following Wednesday's terrorist attack in London. Proving that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, the president's son tweeted, quote, "You have to be kidding me. Terror attacks are part of living in the big city," says London Mayor Sadiq Khan, end quote. In typical Trumpian fashion, the younger Donald misrepresented the London mayor's quote. Mayor Khan had been commiserating with New York City after the September bombings in that city. He actually said that supporting police and terrorism preparedness was just, quote, "part and parcel of living in a great global city," end quote. Also in true Trumpian fashion, Donald Jr. refused to apologize for his error and said, quote, "I'm not going to comment on every tweet I send," end quote.
Judges traditionally stay out of politics, but the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court accused federal immigration officials of, quote, "stalking undocumented immigrants at trial courts." Scott Schaefer has this report.
Traditionally stay out of politics, but the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court accused federal immigration officers of stalking undocumented immigrants at trial courts. KQED's senior editor for politics and government, Scott Schaefer, says other state judges are following suit.
Tani Kantil Sakaue was named Chief Justice by former Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, but she didn't hesitate to fire off a tough letter to the Republican Trump administration when she got wind that immigration agents were operating in courthouses. Her message, knock it off. Now she says the Chief Justice in Washington State has done the same thing, asking the federal government not to enforce immigration laws inside courthouses.
Additionally, I know that the New Mexico Superior Court is hearing many issues and complaints, and they're determining what they can and want to do in this situation. I've read about it in Colorado. I've read about it in Texas. And I know that the chiefs are thinking about this.
The Chief Justice believes the recent immigration crackdown in courthouses will keep crime victims and witnesses away. But so far, the U.S. Attorney General's office will only say it's reviewing the matter. Also not helpful to the judiciary, says Chief Justice Kantil Sakaue, President Trump's disparaging comments about federal judges who oppose policies like his recent travel ban. She calls that kind of rhetoric disappointing.
So I think it is very threatening to the third branch of government. It's an indication of not treating the three branches as co-equal. And it's troubling to all of us to hear that because it is an attack on the public confidence and trust in the judicial branch's rulings.
Next week, the Chief Justice will tell lawmakers what's on her mind when she delivers her annual State of the Judiciary address to a joint session of the legislature. For the California Report, I'm Scott Schaefer.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. If you would like to be part of the KBOO news crew, call or stop by the station. We'd love to have you on the team. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kanan Schlesinger, Jenka Soderberg, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to the Oregon News Service. Our engineer and co-anchor is the multi-talented Jenny Yokoyama. The cable